Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the chips in the BC. It is Saturday, the 11th day of July, Anno Domini 2026, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things, juice, nothing, less, great, obvious, juice, don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. Before we start, I'd like to apologize for losing my voice. I don't know where it went, but I've been looking for it everywhere. For decades, people have been saying that Microsoft tracks everything you do. And for decades, people have offered up ways to hide themselves. Local accounts, VPNs, Tor hopping, etc. Turns out none of that matters because there's a secret unremovable ID in your Windows system that Microsoft sets up when you install Windows. It's called the GDID, or Global Device Identifier. That's right, that GD stands for Global Device, not anything else. It's a unique identifier assigned at each Windows installation. It's used for telemetry, crash reporting, license verification. It operates underneath standard VPN and network protections. It belongs to the deepest layer of the OS. It's even copied to Microsoft servers, and you can't change it, block it, or remove it. How do we know? Because of Peter Stokes. He's a 19-year-old accused of being a member of the Scattered Spider Group. He thought he was safe because he was, that's a hacker's group. He thought he was safe because he was chaining VPNs, cycling through IPs, using tunneling services and firewalls, and hopping between countries to cover his tracks. But the FBI caught him anyway because Microsoft gave them his GDID. People are, understandably, upset. Microsoft never disclosed this undeletable tracker. It has no public policy on when and how it shares the GDID data, and no transparency reports covering GDID disclosures. Oh, and simply reinstall Windows and getting a new GDID achieves nothing. The new GDID can be easily tied to the same underlying hardware and your old Windows account, because all of those data are stored in Microsoft's cloud. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows secret unremovable ID. Your choices are, I don't mind, I'm uneasy about this makes me so mad, just one more reason to switch, and glad I don't use Windows. So far we've got 26 votes, and glad I don't use Windows is a dozen of them, followed by just one more reason to switch. So, yeah, and you can vote in the poll. It's really easy to do. Just head on over to soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And then if you'd like to, you can give us a call and talk about that or dang near anything else. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Or toll free at 800-790-0415. You know, we've talked this over the years about does Microsoft track us? Doesn't Microsoft track us? Well, we know it does. We've always known it does. But there were ways you thought you could block it, right? A whole bunch of different apps and hacks and
use a local account,
registry things,
not a Microsoft
and,
account,
right?
Yeah.
Local accounts and blah blah blah. None of that matters. Not even if you sign on with a local account. That GDID is given to Microsoft with your local account information. So, yes, Microsoft is tracking you, and yes, Microsoft knows who you are, and yes, Microsoft knows where you go. Now, this kid was doing all the hacker stuff. He was using Tor. He was using the dark web. He was hopping between multiple Tors, as a matter of fact. He was using VPNs. He was doing all of the stuff people say, oh, this makes me secure. No, no, it doesn't. No. If you're using Windows, they know who you are. Done. Period. Finished.
You have to write your own OS.
Well, you
to
could
be
use,
sure.
You could use a Mac or Linux. As far as we know.
Yeah, as far as we know.
Well, Linux being open source, a lot of people have checked. And in fact, a lot of people checked this week and said, no, there's nothing in any of the major versions of Linux. Obviously, we don't know about any of the lower end or niche versions of Linux, but certainly in terms of the major versions, Ubuntu and its derivatives and Fedora and its derivatives and et cetera, those are fine. But yeah, I still have that little Windows 2-in-1, that little port, the convertible, where I can pull up the tablet off the keyboard, and I didn't use it all week. I don't need Microsoft to know what I'm doing.
No.
The hell with them. I'm sorry, but the hell with them.
Of course, there's on the other side, there's so much data they're not tracking you specifically. Unless someone asks.
Yeah. But they still can.
Yeah, they can, yeah.
Right. And the FBI specifically said, who is this guy? And Microsoft just said, oh, no, here he is.
Yeah.
Well, there have been a couple of cases like that with cell company blanket warrants. You know, a bank gets robbed, and the police go, give me every cell phone that was in half a mile of that bank.
Mm-hmm.
And different courts have ruled that illegal or legal or unconstitutional or not.
Yeah, invasion of privacy.
There's no, the burden of proof is on the police, and there's no, I guess there's the assumption that the thief had a phone.
Right.
Which would be pretty stupid if you're going to,
track you going into the bank and coming out.
You're going to rob a bank. Big tip today.
Yeah.
If you're going to rob a bank, which you shouldn't do, don't bring your phone.
Yeah. Or your computer.
That's one thing, though, nowadays, and maybe it's just my naiveness, is you don't hear very many bank robberies because of the security cameras and everything else and the glass and everything else that most of the banks.
It's easier to steal electronic money than physical money.
Yep.
In fact, much easier. You know, the biggest, there was a Brinks robbery of like $10 million. The biggest bank robbery is $4.5 billion in crypto.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So yeah. But big tip, if you're going to do something illegal, don't bring your phone.
Yeah.
To our phones. And we're talking to Ed in Ithaca, New York, who we hope is doing nothing illegal. Hi, Ed. What's up?
Well, hi, guys. Thank you. I just left my phone at home because I'm about to enter the bank. So you saved me again.
Our pleasure. Second tip, take off the mask before you go into the bank now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. You don't want.
You need to write this down, Ed. Doggone it. What's up?
Right. Well, so maybe you can solve something else. I just got a Neo, Mac Neo, a couple weeks ago, and I am trying to connect my iPhone 7, which I use solely as an iPod, to it and sync them, and it is not doing that. It's when I go into Finder and go into the phone, it says it will back it up, and then I press sync and nothing happens.
So it sees the Windows. It sees the phone there but isn't syncing.
That's correct.
Do you know what
it's
OS...
It's showing up on Windows also.
Yeah, do you know what OS is running on the phone?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I'd be afraid that the OS on an iPhone 7 is too old for a modern iTunes or modern Mac.
I see. Okay, that might be... where would I find it?
Settings, General, About.
Okay, Settings.
And I'm trying to find a system requirement for both iTunes and iPhone 7.
About 15.8.3.
15? So that's only two versions behind, so that shouldn't be too bad. They always say the OS required is 15 or later, but you're probably running 26 on the Neo because that's the newest.
Yep.
And let me see. iPhone 7 needs iTunes 12.5 or later, but it's possible it's too... Well, and the syncing portion is not done by the iTunes app anymore. It's done directly in the Finder.
In the Finder, right.
Yeah.
That's how I do it on my old MacBook, too.
Yeah.
Same phone. Yeah. Could it be because this phone is known to another Mac, in my MacBook Air, that it would...
It should ask if you want to erase it and sync it to this this computer. So you can only sync to one computer at a time.
Okay. Yeah. It was not asked.
And there's no real way to uninstall and reinstall iTunes.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
Try a different USB cable, perhaps? Or, are you using a C to A adapter, or do you have a straight Lightning to C?
Straight C to Lightning. C to Lightning. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still looking here, but I almost think they're just too far apart.
Hmm.
It could be the cable, because... If it's a generic cable, it may be data only.
That could be.
Oh, that's a possibility.
Yeah, bad wire or connection in it,
or or power only. So
I meant power.
Yeah, so it won't do.
Yeah,
it won't do data.
It is charging off the Neo.
Yeah, try a different cable is all we can suggest.
And the
cable is cheap enough. It's not a.
Yeah.
In terms of troubleshooting, it's pretty cheap.
And the first time you plug it in, the phone should say, trust this computer, and the computer should say, trust this phone.
This was a couple of weeks ago, and I can't remember if it did that or not.
Right, okay. But get a new cable, and if it doesn't say that, that cable is definitely power only.
Okay, I will check on that.
Also, on the Neo... The ports are different. I got to remember.
Oh, yeah. The back port is fast and the front port is slow.
Yeah, the back port is USB 3 and the front one's USB 2. So try the other port.
So I have the charging cable plugged into the back port. Let me switch them. Well, let me take out the charging cable and put it in the back port. Go to the Finder. Open phone. Press sync.
So the fact that it sees the phone implies it's a data cable. But it wouldn't hurt to try another cable.
Okay, I can do that.
Mm-hmm. And let us know what happens.
Okay, I will. If you have another 2 seconds, I have another question. 2 questions.
Go ahead.
First question is, do you ever find out who Francis is?
No.
Who's Francis?
Francis.
Remember Francis?
Yeah, I don't remember who Francis is. I apologize.
Okay. Because I know you said before one of your anniversaries, maybe if Francis is there, she'll come up and talk to us.
That would be nice. Is there an AI that can read audio files? Because we have the archive. Somewhere in there, you probably, when you very first started saying Bites with Y, as Francis said, we might have talked about Francis.
Might have talked about Francis.
So we gotta send the archives into an audio AI.
I tried that. It was terrible.
Yeah?
It was terrible. We talk fast and we talk over each other.
No, really?
No, we wouldn't do something like that.
What was your other question, Ed?
The other question is a little bit more serious. There's something I think it's called Send Local.
Yeah.
Is that something you think is clean and useful?
I use it quite regularly.
Local Send, wasn't it?
Local Send, it's called.
Local Send, yes. Mm-hmm.
I use it all the time, and it's fast, and it's convenient, and it's for every operating system on the planet.
Right. Okay, good. Thank you. I've tried it between a Mac and a PC, and it worked, but I just wasn't sure if there were any caveats I should be aware of.
No, I haven't found any. I really like it.
Okay, super. Well, thanks so much, guys, and I'm proud to be a contributing member.
That's what we love to hear. Thank you, Ed.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Yeah, LocalSend is a little utility I found. You can put it on as many machines as you want. It's for every operating system on the planet, and it lets you move files from one device to another over your local network, so it doesn't go out to the internet. So, for example, in my case, I have a half a gigabyte green light connection, but I have a gigabit switch. So moving data between machines that are hardwired takes no time at all. First time I did it, I thought something went wrong.
Yeah.
I use that constantly now to move files among machines. Okay.
He didn't say where it is.
All right. Our next caller, if I can get this to work, yes. Our next caller is Ken, calling from where in Maryland, Ken?
Oh, I'm outside of Baltimore, not too far.
Baltimore, nice area. What's up?
I got a question about Yahoo Mail. A couple of weeks ago, the notification icon on above the Yahoo Mail stopped incrementing. It doesn't tell me when I get new mail. Have you heard anything about that, why it stopped working?
What did it stop at?
It doesn't give me any notification at all anymore when I get new mail. I didn't change anything on the computer, and I tried it on other computers, and same result.
I've seen mine has stopped at $9.99 plus, so it stopped counting after 1,000.
Well, when you read your mail, it actually goes back to zero again, so mine never got that high.
Yeah. Is this on your phone or on your computer?
No, this is on a laptop.
I
don't know.
Yeah, I'd never get that high.
Yeah, when I see that happen, delete the account and add it back again, fixes it.
So, okay, I would start with a couple of things. First, it may be, check your settings in Yahoo. You may have...
Yeah, I went through all that. I checked all my settings, and it says I'm supposed to get notifications when I get new mail. I checked that off.
But like Steve said, though...
What about the Android notification settings?
He's not in Android. He's on desktop.
On desktop, okay.
But like you said, though, deleting it and redoing it, just because of Windows updates and everything else, it changes other files within the system. So deleting the account and reestablishing, it could help
is this
out.
Is this the Yahoo app?
Well,
or is
it about deleting the cat. You mean logging out and logging back in.
Wait, is this in the browser?
Yeah, in the browser, in the Firefox.
In that case, the other thing I would check is your browser permissions. You may have blocked something.
Right.
For example.
Now, the other thing I'm still getting, I get push notifications when I get mail, but that icon never changes the number.
Yeah, they're different. They would be different things. So check. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of people have added an extension that blocks JavaScript. Well, it's JavaScript that does that.
No, I didn't add any extension on any of the computers recently. All of a sudden, it just stopped working a few weeks ago.
There's nothing.
Yahoo recently updated their mail system at the other end.
The other thing I would try is, the little padlock icon to the left of the URL in the address bar?
Yeah.
Check. Click on that and see if notifications is set to allow.
Yeah, I think I did that. Everything looks good there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the Yahoo Mail has to be notified and the Firefox browser has to allow notifications.
Yeah, right. It could be something in the Firefox update recently. Maybe they broke it.
It's Firefox. Yeah, that's the little speech bubble icon in the address bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, click on that and verify that notifications are not blocked for that site.
Right.
And the other thing is,
about it, I didn't do anything on any of the computers. It doesn't stop working on all of them.
It could be the other end.
Yeah.
It's probably something at Yahoo, but they don't have any contact information where you can get help, do they?
Nope.
No free help. There is paid help.
There is paid help. But I would check that bubble icon in Firefox. The other thing is, are you on Windows?
Yeah, it's on Windows 11.
Okay. Then in that case, go to Settings, System, Notifications.
Yeah, I went there and I checked. Everything looks good there.
Mm-hmm. For the browser?
Yep.
Okay. Then I've given you everything we know.
Yeah, you would think they would get a lot of complaints and they would have fixed it by now, but I guess not.
Yeah, you would think so.
Well, I can live without it anyway. It's not that important. It's just
an annoyance.
We usually get the opposite question. How can I stop that 2,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 from showing up on my dock icon?
Right.
Read your mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I just thought maybe you heard something about it, but evidently not. All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Yep.
Yeah, I am sorry.
Let me see what my email does.
Ever since he started talking, I've been trying to log into Yahoo.
Me too. I don't remember setting a passkey for Yahoo.
No, that is my password.
Yahoo! Yeah, you got to say it right. Maybe that's the problem. You got to say it right.
That must be it. Come on. What the heck, Rooney? Okay, there we go. I'm just trying to find my Yahoo password. Oh, yeah, okay. Let's try this one. Yeah, like that.
Too many. Oh, I'm down to 924 new messages, so it's still counting them. Because I don't use Yahoo, so every single message is crap.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still trying to log in because it won't give me my verification code. There we go.
Ooh, important changes to Yahoo Mail Storage. Yeah, this is, so Yahoo used to give you 20 gigs used to give you unlimited storage.
Right.
Now they're dropping that to 20 gigabytes of mail storage, which is the most generous of all of the major mail providers. So if you have more than 20 gigs of mail stored at Yahoo, you're either going to have to pay for more storage or start deleting. 100 gigs is $2 a month.
Okay, back with them. I asked for a text message with the verification number.
Mm-hmm.
It sent it to me. I put it in. It said, thank you. And then it said, sending a text, a verification code to your email. No. No, I'm done. I don't care how many more times you want it. You're not getting it. The hell with it.
Oh, computers, you just got to love them.
No, you don't. No, you don't. There are days I don't. Yeah.
That's when you find other things to do.
Right.
You know, it's right. Like, yeah, maybe I need to go out and do this or do that and, you know, occupy it. Because you're sure to put your fist through it or throwing it out the window.
Yeah, it might be time to break out the banjo. I will say one more thing about LocalSend. It is a free, tiny little program that runs on every operating system. For somebody like Ed, who's talking about, you know, he's got his music on one machine and he wants to move it to the other machine,
mm-hmm.
It is the fastest way.
Yeah.
And it all remains local, and that's a big thing. You know, there's none of this, I upload it
up to the internet and then back down.
Back to here, and do I have enough space up there, and how long is that going to take, and it's the other end that's slow, and yada, yada. I don't need any of that.
No.
I hit the button. Each machine, I say send and receive.
It's a direct connect.
2 minutes later, you're done, and you're done. And it's a beautiful, simple, easy little program. I am very impressed with it, and I am recommending it to everybody. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and with you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Hey, we're member-supported. You could probably make a donation at jazz901.org. Hit that big red Donate Now button. We'll see you in a couple of minutes.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Pat from Webster, New York, on the line. What's up, Pat?
Hi. How you doing, Nick? We haven't chatted in a while, so we're not kids anymore, but I have just a little question.
Yeah.
It's not creating any problem. My husband uses Windows 7, and where the toolbar is, the other day, about 12 icons appeared. They're only about a quarter inch in size. And they're all lined up there in a row, and it's the typical ones, the control panel, Google, pictures, just like the toolbar. How do we get rid of them without losing our programs?
It sounds like you accidentally turned on another toolbar. Right-click on an empty spot.
On that toolbar.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to uncheck that toolbar so it doesn't show.
Okay, so it won't delete any of my programs then, right?
No, toolbar.
I put it in the recycle bin, but then it took it away, so we restored it.
Yeah. No, you don't throw it in the recycle bin. You just right-click on it and turn it off.
And that will show you the list of toolbars that are on, and you uncheck it.
Where the task manager is?
Sorry, didn't hear
the, on that toolbar itself, where those extra icons are.
On the toolbar, and it will bring up where you can uncheck. The toolbar should be locked, right?
You'll have to unlock the toolbar so that you can hide this one toolbar.
Okay, all right.
You click on it in the black?
Yeah, you click on the black, right. All right, well, we didn't want to cause any problems, so we were going to just deal with it, but we thought we'd give you a shout.
Yeah, no, sure. Once you unlock it, just right-click on it and then uncheck that toolbar. You'll be fine.
Okay, very good. I appreciate the info.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, somebody once said if you turn on all the toolbars in Windows, there's no space for icons.
Yeah, that's true of so many of those things.
Yeah.
They just...
Sound about your name.
You can add... And that happens with browsers as well. When you install something, one of the checkboxes you don't read says install this toolbar. And you end up with so many toolbars you can't see anything on the screen.
Yep.
We see that more often than not. You need to read carefully everything you do before you click on it. So that should help Pat and her husband. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is not there. Dave's going to figure out what he did. If we hung up on you, please call back.
Still getting used to the new phone system.
Sorry, that was Judy. I apologize, Judy. Please call back.
Oop, now the phone doesn't work at all. Have you turned it off and turned it back on again?
It keeps hanging up on you.
Well, while we wait for something to happen
Unplug the Ethernet. Wait a minute and plug it back in.
That's exactly right. Oh, we're getting another call in. All right, so we'll just we'll vamp till ready. Oh, look, the new phone line. I actually can see who's calling.
Oh, nice.
That's very cool. I mean, that's someone's calling. It's blinking red now instead of...
Because someone else picked it up. Another extension picked it up.
It's very cool. We have a new phone system, for those of you who don't know, which we didn't, by the way.
Until we show up one day.
Until we showed up last 2 weeks ago. I can see that The new phone system is significantly different from the old phone system, and we'll see if this works this time. We have Don from Pittsford, New York, on the line. What's up, Don?
Yes, hi. Waiting here. A couple of weeks ago, you spoke about the. I'm sorry. My name is Don. I thought I was on the air.
You are on the air, Don. Go ahead. No, Dave was on the phone and forgot to.
I would
turn off his mic. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. A couple of weeks ago, you were talking about the 2080 or 1090 rule regarding using and charging lithium-ion batteries, and I was unable to ask the question then, but now, if you can, how do you determine that charging range when the battery or the device has no indication of the percentage of charge?
You run another program that does have a percentage of charge.
Most of them have a setting. For example, are you talking about a phone or a laptop or what?
I'm talking about various devices. Unfortunately, I have ruined a very expensive jump starter for a car battery and a searchlight because we're gone to a winter address for 3 months, and I decided it was better to leave these off charge than on. And now both batteries are shot. There's no indication on either one about the charge percentage.
Yeah, not every battery gives you that.
And some have a light. Or my jump starter's got a 25, 50, 75 full light.
Yeah, but
not all may.
Not all do, and not all give you the option to say stop at 80.
Yeah.
So, and I get that. There's no.
Which should be changing now. New devices should have that circuitry built into it now.
Right.
Should.
The point is that this was an unknown thing a couple of years ago. And it is some new information as people became spent more time figuring out what's actually going on inside a lithium ion battery.
Storing it at too high a charge is bad. Storing it at too low a charge is bad.
Right, and charging it too high or letting it go too low is bad.
And if there's no indication on the thing, then you have no idea what it's charging and discharging at.
Now for laptops. Sorry, go ahead, Don.
Exactly.
Yeah, and
what would you recommend in my situation where we are gone for 3 months of the winter? Is it, obviously, it's not a good idea to leave everything plugged in on charge unless the charger itself has a monitor and a turn-off switch.
Yeah, that's what you
don't.
A battery.
That's what you have to get, a battery conditioner, battery monitor.
Well, they've
got. It'll trickle charge it, but it won't charge it all the way.
There's an item called a battery tender. And battery tender will only do maintenance. You know, it'll charge it, and then it maintains it. Once it hits there, it doesn't charge anymore. It just keeps it.
Can you set it to 80%?
No, you can't set it. It's just.
Yeah, you're better off with something that lets you set the charging limit, if you can find one.
Yeah.
I mean, if you know.
I don't think you're going to find one that'll
do. You might not, but at the very least, the tender that Dave is talking about is probably
where
you want to be.
The only reason I'm speaking from experience on that is for, like, during the summer months and the winter months, you know, I'm usually either it's the lawnmower or, say, the snowblower is on this battery tender, and it maintains just a trickle charge. It's not, you know, just something to keep it alive and not overcharge it and, you know, burn out cells and everything else. And I've had batteries, heck, by using that last me, you know, up to 5 to 7 years.
So battery tender is the thing you're looking for, Don.
I use a battery tender on my car battery, which is stored. The car is stored in North Carolina. However, that plugs into 110, and it has either an option of 6 or 12-volt output.
Right.
The battery tender that I would be looking for is one that takes the that provides the proper output for these batteries, which are generally 12 volts in, cell phone, whatever. The other, and I'm wondering if the battery maintainer that you've described provides that kind of output to go directly into the charger, into the device.
I'm looking at, I just did a Google search for battery tender 12 volt. And there's a bucket load of them.
Okay. I'll take a look at that.
And when you're buying a new device with a battery in it, make sure it has some sort of a either battery status level or a battery storage charge built into it.
And you mentioned a cell phone. Most cell phones will let you set the maximum charge.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my iPhone does not. Interesting.
That's in settings under battery.
Yeah. Pixel does. My old Samsung did.
Yeah.
I'm sure iPhones do. They must. How old is your iPhone? What version?
It is an SE second version. Probably about 2.5 years old, 2.5, 3 years old. Where would I go and what menu to try and find that utility to set the charge limits?
Settings, battery.
Okay. All right.
And then you can set both a minimum and a maximum charge.
Sometimes. Apple calls it optimized battery charging.
Well, there you go.
Okay, I'll check that out. Thank you. Now, what do you think about this idea? Since I'm gone and we have a person that checks on the house when we're gone for 3 months, however, they're really not equipped to, for one reason or another, to deal with battery charging. Put using a timer that will... that will time down to a minimum of 1 hour in 24 hours. What do you think about using that and having the devices plugged in, the 120 transformers plugged into that timer so that the batteries receive a charge but only 1 hour a day? Is that
well, then there's nothing to discharge it, so then you're going to overcharge it again.
Yeah.
Right. My phone, when it is just sitting, only loses about 2 or 3% in a day. 5% overnight.
Oh.
Okay, let's call it 5% overnight, and that's 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So call it 10% in 24 hours. If you charge it, you get much more than 10% in 24 in 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
So you will be
overcharging
every time. You'll be getting more than you lost
every
time. So in 3 months...
I wonder if that's also true of really heavy-duty multi-amp batteries for jump starter and, in this case, the searchlight that I have.
Yeah, that's why you want a trickle charger, which just maintains a steady flow of, you know, let it be at 80%, you know, wear it down for an hour or two, put it on the trickle charger and leave.
Is that trickle charger output for a 110-volt plug-in device like the transformer, or is it output 12 volts and requires a compatible plug to go directly into the device?
It depends on which one you buy. There are many, many battery tenders. You just have to buy the one you want.
All right. I'll search through Google or a chat and see what I can come up with. Thank you again, gentlemen. I appreciate your good information and the time you spent.
All right. Thank you, Don.
Bye.
And then he's got the added issue that he's not necessarily there all the time to watch it if there's a problem.
Right. Well, yeah. But in phones, you generally, these days... What is that noise?
Yeah, there's a fan making a noise in here.
Yeah.
That's the bane of every radio station. Where's that noise coming from?
Where's that noise coming from? If you can hear it, we apologize.
Yeah, that's why Rob's tearing the studio apart, trying to find where that noise is coming from.
Yeah.
But the other thing that hurts batteries is temperature fluctuations.
Right.
So if you can bring your battery indoors, I do that with my lawnmower battery, bring it inside instead of leaving it in the shed all
right,
the way
right.
along.
Don't leave it in the shed, don't leave it in the garage, put it in the basement or somewhere, you know, somewhere else.
Where it's cool, it doesn't get hot. You don't want it to get hot.
Where it stays cool but doesn't get cold. Where it stays warm but doesn't get hot. That's, you know, the garage is not the place for it. The shed is not the place for it. For long-term storage.
Yep.
Right. I mean, obviously, you know, over the summer while you're actually using it, assuming you mow your lawn.
We just had this big argument at our airplane board meeting. One of the guys was asking about Smart Batteries, which is a brand from one of the big companies, Spectrum. And... when you plug the battery in to charge it with a smart charger, see, that's the gig. You have to use all smart.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to tell it the capacity, the cell level, the watt hour. It knows because there's a data port.
Sure.
And the battery auto-discharges if you don't use it.
Oh.
So it goes back to storage level, 3.7 volts per cell. And one of the other guys is, well, that sounds like a lot of fuss. And, well, ooh. Yeah, but, okay. And then the other guy says, well, what do you mean you leave the field with charged batteries? Just fly again.
Yeah, right.
Well, maybe it started raining and I can't fly again.
Or so the windy.
Yeah, so then you have to go home and discharge all your batteries manually. And we've had a couple of meetings about that. One guy built a incandescent light bulb fixture thingy because the incandescent bulbs draw so much power.
Right.
So he could drain his batteries down in a couple hours. Each battery in a couple hours. And most of the chargers will have a draining to put back to storage level system. And so paying a little bit extra for smart batteries can be useful because you don't have to fuss with the charger to charge it. And they discharge themselves.
Battery technology is fussy.
Yeah.
Batteries are fussy. The problem is dendrites. If you want to look it up, they're called dendrites.
Lithium dendrites.
Lithium dendrites. Oh, thank you. And we'll let you look that up. Then we'll leave that as an exercise to the listener while we talk to Judy from Penfield, from Webster, New York. What's up, Judy?
Okay. This is a phone question. I have an Android Samsung S21. And every once in a while, a voicemail is left in my notifications. And I never knew about pulling down the screen to look at notifications until about 6 months ago. So I have no idea how many voicemails I have missed because those voicemails do not go into my voicemail. And there's no record of them in the call log of my phone. This does not make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. What?
I've been to T-Mobile. They made me feel like an idiot. All she kept saying to me is, well, you get notifications and you get mail and you get voicemail.
What usually I see happen is a voicemail pops up and the phone never rang for me to answer it to begin with.
Right. There are two places that Samsung keeps its information for this. One is making sure that Do Not Disturb is off.
Yes, it's always off.
Right. And your notification volume is up, which is separate from the volume of the phone. It's a separate notification. It's a separate volume. And then in settings, are you using the Samsung messaging system voicemail or the Google voicemail or the your carrier's voicemail?
Of course, you would ask me that.
Yeah, because it may be in the other one that you're not using.
Right. Assuming it's in Samsung's, you can go to settings, apps, messages, notifications, and make sure allow notifications is on and that it is set to make a sound.
Okay, wait a minute. Settings?
Settings, apps.
I'm posting a link, too.
Oh, Steve's posting a link, so you don't need to write anything down.
Amps. After apps, what do I do?
Settings, apps, messages, notifications.
Messages.
And make sure that allow notifications is turned on and that it is going to make a sound.
It says messages. There are two message apps.
Yeah, one probably Samsung.
And one probably Android. So check both.
I'm using the Samsung one.
Well, check both just in case.
Notifications, it says blocked.
Blocked, yeah, so unblock it.
Okay.
That should do it. What's happening is those notifications are being blocked, and therefore you will never see them. They still are there, but you don't get a notification.
So that if they leave a voicemail like that again, it'll go into my voicemail?
Theoretically, yes. It depends on where you're getting your voicemail. Like I said, there are three separate places. Samsung has their own, Android has their own, and your carrier has their own.
Well, I'm using the one with the eyeglasses turned upside down.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I apologize. I don't know that icon. But so that, you know, you got to check all three of those. Find that icon and check the settings, the notification settings for that as well.
You might want to check with inside that app and, you know, through the menu if there's a help or about that particular application to know which one you're using.
Yeah, find that app in your list of apps.
And usually there's settings and all that in there, and there's maybe help about what version it might be or that type of stuff to give you some idea of what you're doing.
Eyeglasses upside down, it's a reel-to-reel tape recorder.
And what app is that?
Well, there's a blue one and there's a red one, and they both say Samsung voicemail.
I have a blue one.
Okay, so
your Samsung,
yeah. So in the apps,
yeah.
So go to settings, then apps. I think we just did this.
Yeah.
Settings, apps, notifications, and allow notifications. You said that was blocked, so unblock that. You should get them now. Have someone send you. Have someone call you and don't answer. See what happens.
Okay.
Call somebody and have them leave you. Don't answer it. And leave a message.
That's what I'm saying. If somebody call her, she doesn't answer. They leave a message.
Well, that's the key thing, though. You got to tell them to leave a message. Right. Sometimes if they don't pick up, I just say the heck with it and hang up. Call them again later.
Well, the strange thing is that it only does it it only did it every once in a while.
Right, and that depends on which program is picking up your voicemail.
Okay.
Like I said, there's multiple programs, and it depends on which one gets it. And I don't know how your phone is set up, but some calls might go through voicemail with your carrier, and some might go through voicemail with Samsung. So make sure it's that you've unblocked it. And then have someone give you a call and see where it goes and see if you get it.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's one of the problems with all of these things. When you have multiple applications that are all using the same concept and often have similar names and even similar icons.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to tell which one you're looking at and which one you're actually playing with. All right, listen, That music tells us that we are done for another for the first hour. But do not despair. There's a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show coming your way. That's right. A whole nother hour of Dave Enright. A whole nother hour of Steve Ray. A whole nother hour of me, Nick Francesco. And a whole nother hour of you. But only, and I promise you, only if you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll-free at 800-790-0415. You are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites right here on the truly great and truly, truly grateful to you that we continue to be member-supported. Jazz90.1.org, Jazz901.org. Hit that big red Donate Now button. See you in just a few.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Sound Bites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, you were hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. And we have Fred from Rochester, New York on the line. What's up, Fred?
Hey, I just wanted to add to the caller about the voicemails.
Yeah.
I have a Samsung Galaxy A54. It's with Metro by T-Mobile, which is close to what the other person was using. I work in an environment that is like a Faraday cage, and I don't get calls. I don't get any internet in certain places. And I often don't even get a missed call notification because the call never made it into the phone.
Right.
So there's no notification for a missed call, but sometime after I get outside, I see, oh, I have a voicemail. And even if I clear the notification for the voicemail is still there when I check voicemail. I have to dial up voicemail. And it's with the Metro. So I call the number for voicemail, and it says I have 3 new voicemails. Well, I only got one notification. But the other two were happened when I was in that spot where I'm getting no reception.
Right.
But the voicemail part's still working. So, you know, what she's not seeing on the phone may differ than if she just calls the voicemail number that's programmed into that service.
Interesting point. Thank you, Fred.
Okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Well, good luck. Take care now.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye. Also, it depends on whether you're getting your voicemail via the data service of the phone or over Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are places where you could be in a Wi-Fi dead spot.
Steve, where are you coming from?
So, for example, there is a room in our house where we have no Wi-Fi reception. We could still get data. We could still get phone service there, cell service, but we couldn't get Wi-Fi there. So when my phone is set to Wi-Fi calling, I don't get calls.
Yeah.
If I'm in that room.
It always annoys me that it's one or the other. It should be both.
Yeah, you would think.
If one doesn't work, try the other one. Theoretically, Wi-Fi calling is supposed to be used when cellular signal is weak.
Right.
But if Wi-Fi is weak, keep using cellular.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Rochester, New York. What's up, Steve?
Yeah.
Okay, what's up?
Oh, okay, that's me. Okay, I said Greece. I'm not really in Greece. They asked the question they asked me. Okay, this is what the problem is. I got a HDD SATA 2 terabyte internal hard drive that I had connected to this new computer that I bought and activated Windows 11 Home version. I did not know it was encrypting that additional drive on top of the one that was on a different hard drive, internal M2 type drive. And when I found out, I had taken that out. I had an older computer. I bought this new one because I couldn't upgrade it. It was a 6th generation I-series. But I put that in, and I used Linux on that one. And
right.
I discovered that my hard drive was getting encrypted, and I unencrypted it without that additional drive in there. Now, for some reason, I went over there on the Linux system, and I couldn't go onto there without this 48 BitLocker encryption code for BitLocker. All right, now I can't unencrypt it now because I unencrypted the other drive, but this one wasn't in there when I did the unencrypted process using the Windows Home version, which is a hybrid version of BitLocker. And it doesn't work the same way the Pro version does.
Right.
And I can't get this darn thing unencrypted now because it wasn't in there when I unencrypted the original drive.
I understand that.
Is there
now,
any way I can do this?
So you're saying that Windows 11 Home is no longer on that system?
No, Windows 11 is on. It's on the newer computer that I bought with Windows 11. Yes, it's still on there. But the thing is, the additional drive, which I did not realize was being encrypted, they didn't give me any warning when I activated the operating system.
So that you took that. I'm sorry, stop. You took that out of the Windows 11 machine and put it in the Linux machine?
Right.
Take it out of the Linux machine, put it back in the Windows 11 machine, go to Control Panel, System and Security,
yeah,
BitLocker drive encryption, find that drive, click Turn Off BitLocker, confirm by saying decrypt the drive, and then wait like 3 days.
I've tried doing that, but it keeps telling me there's nothing to unencrypt on there. The only way I can get into this is using that 48 password code key, and that's a pain. I didn't want to encrypt it in the first place.
You may need to use PowerShell, which will let you disable BitLocker on a specific drive letter.
Okay, PowerShell.
Which is Microsoft's PowerShell.
It's
a super whiz-bang DOS prompt.
It's pseudo for DOS.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I posted a link on how to use...
Yeah, so there's a link on how to do that on our website.
Yeah, because basically, in this circumstance, the only way I could think of saving what's on there, because I got two partitions. One part of it I just totally erased after I put in the 48 key. It erased that one partition, which I had a backup of Windows 11 on there. But the other part, I got like 1.8 terabytes of data on there. And the only way I can think of, I went to their customer support. And they were telling me the only way I can do this is to go through the BitLocker unencryption process with the 48 passcode key. And then after you've unencrypted it, you have to erase the drive and reformat it. But I want to get the data off first, but I don't have any place else to transfer the data on to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you are going to want to save those data somewhere.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, I don't have any additional drives to transfer that stuff off before. So basically, the only way I can do this right now under the circumstance would be to erase it with all the data on it and lose everything on it and then reformat it.
Well, if you want to turn it into into a regular Linux ext4 drive, yes, you're going to have to do that. But if you want to continue to use it as an NTFS drive, you don't have to do that, but it's not going to be quite as fast.
Yeah. Well, basically, I just can't find a solution to this problem, and I tried their customer support, and they told me the only way I can do it is that way. And, oh, yeah, okay, I got to go out and spend 200 hours more on another 2-terabyte drive and transfer everything over. Then I can erase everything. That's the only way I can. I want to save this data before I unencrypt it somehow. And I can't figure out how I can do this.
The reality is you can't. I'm sorry, but the reality is that Microsoft doesn't have an option to just decrypt the drive, reformat it without losing the data. You do have to save those data somewhere. And I wish I had a better answer for you, but there just isn't one.
Yeah, it is what it is.
The PowerShell option may work to decrypt the data.
It'll decrypt it, but it won't let him reformat the drive without losing the data.
Right. There's just no way around that.
Yeah, I can get into it, but every time I get into it, I got to use this 48 code key every time, this BitLocker unencryption code key they get.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pain, especially because I wanted to use that in a Linux operating system on a different computer.
Right.
And it's just a total headache. Well, thanks for that. I'll try that option now. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Good luck, Steve.
Yeah, have a good day now.
Thanks, you too.
You ran into something similar with that last Windows machine you bought to convert to Linux?
But what I did, well, I didn't have any data on it.
Yeah.
So I knew it was going to encrypt the drive. I just knew that. So I went in and decrypted it before I did anything else.
Yeah. Apple does the same thing, but at least they ask if you want to turn on File Vault encryption. But they give you all the benefits, but they don't give you any of the warnings. So encryption is great because no one else can see your files without the password. But neither can you.
Right.
If you forget the password, data's gone.
Also,
if something goes wrong with one little bit and the encryption is now unreadable, your data is gone.
Also, the minute you log in, it decrypts your data. So if somebody's in your machine stealing your stuff through an exploit of some sort, your data are unencrypted. What's the point of BitLocker?
I saw this rig once. Where laptops, yeah, you unplug it from the wall and the battery keeps it running. And so it stays unencrypted. But a desktop, you unplug it from the wall, it powers off, right? No. They had this rig where it had clamps, and very carefully you strip the power cord so you could see the wires. You clamp it on there. This rig had a battery on it. So then you could unplug it from the wall and cart it away. I guess the police are using it to confiscate computers while they're still running.
Yep.
I don't know if I'd want to strip live wires.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's got to be an OSHA mishap ready to happen.
Because I've seen induction wires where it's the clamp that goes around the outside of the wire will tell if there's power flowing through
it
with no physical connection.
Right.
But I need both the hot and the
ground
to actually keep power flowing.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. What's up, Mark?
Hello, everybody. Isn't it a wonderful day?
It's a beautiful day in my neighborhood.
Sure is. Question for you. I've got a 2019 Acer Nitro AN515-53 laptop, okay? And it hasn't had a BIOS update since basically when I bought it, okay? And now Microsoft is pushing a BIOS update through Windows Update for the boot certificates.
Right.
And I've read everywhere that this update is a problem.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
For some people, not for everybody.
Yeah, well, I really don't want to be a guinea pig. But the problem is I can't get this BIOS update any other way. The BIOS update comes through Inside with a Y Corp. And Acer has no other update on their website for it, other than the current one that I have, which is the most recent one that they posted.
Eventually, 2019 shouldn't be that old, but eventually they stopped releasing updates.
Right. Well, they stopped releasing updates when this one was put out. I had one BIOS update when I bought it, and that was it.
Was it? Oh. While Nick is looking, there was an unrelated... I don't remember if it was just France or the whole EU passed a law banning planned obsolescence. So companies can no longer call their products obsolete? How does that work?
Right.
You have to support a product forever?
So you've gone to Acer's site.
Yeah.
Looked up the BIOS.
Yep, I put in my serial number, which is the easiest way to do it.
Right, it's support.acer.com.
All my updates, yeah. And pretty much every update that's there on the Acer site is all up to 2019. And then I still get updates for other things through Intel with their driver support assistance. I get my Wi-Fi update and my Bluetooth updates. But those are the only, and even those are not up to date on the Acer website.
Yeah, if that's the latest one, then that's the latest one. And in terms of the, are you sure it's a BIOS update you're getting and not just a certificates update?
It from all indications that I've read, this is the, let's see, I'll give you the KB. It is KB5095093. Then it's 26200.8737.
That left elbow. Yeah, that's a Windows update.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is the one that is supposed to give you the secure boot stuff.
Mm-hmm. But when I go to look up what it is, it says it is part of a BIOS update. But that's the only information I can find on it.
I don't see anything called BIOS on the Microsoft page.
Yeah, no, it changes the boot.stl file, but that's not really the BIOS.
Okay.
So it shouldn't. It changes your boot sector. It changes the EFI, which is a boot thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't change the BIOS on the motherboard.
Okay. So it's a way of adding the certificate.
Right, right. They're just changing, theoretically, the certificates.
Which are going to expire, which would then stop your computer from accessing secure.
Right,
which
I really don't want to do.
Yeah.
You know, they put these things on here for a reason, and then they make it difficult for you to get what you need to get.
Of course. Well, at least you understand what's going on.
Okay, I appreciate the help.
All right, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yep, bye-bye.
Windows 11 24H2 will reach end of updates on October 13th, 2026.
Maybe.
This year.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's Windows 11.
Yeah.
So they still.
No. What they're saying is.
You have to upgrade to 25H2.
Right. They're saying they're, if you're upgrading Windows 11 to Windows 11, it already runs on Windows 11, that update will work. It's Windows 10 that they gave us another year.
Yeah, but
because,
I still.
Because there's 25 friggin' million people who have not updated to Windows 11.
And I still don't trust the Windows updates to the Windows.
Yeah.
It's no different than the other previous versions of Windows. Like you've said countless times, every time they do an update, we are the beta testers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you get to sit there and maybe hope that they checked when they put that update out there that it's not going to brick your machine or cause other things not to work.
That's right.
So they can sit there and say, well, this version's coming out. Maybe.
Right. Right.
Maybe.
Right.
But
yeah, so, that, well, yeah, I solved that problem by going to Linux 30
yep.
years ago. But the point is that if you are going to stick with Windows, you best stick with the latest version you can handle because Microsoft is very much like Apple. At some point, they're just going to say, you know what? Move or die. We mm-hmm. don't care. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too bad.
Oh, that's the way life goes.
I should read this one particular bit of news. This is the most significant thing here. At last, our long national nightmare is over.
At last.
Yes, after 18 years, Hannah Montana Linux has finally received an update.
So soon?
Bringing nearly two decades of enhancements to functionality, user experience, and security. But you'll need 8 gigs of RAM to run it. It's a significant upgrade over whatever your current Hannah Montana machine has. Yes, there is a version of Linux called Hannah Montana Linux. What's your favorite part of that? It's the pink theme, isn't it? It's the fact that everything's pink. I mean, everything.
Yeah.
Everything is pink.
Well, there's a lot of folks that would love it.
That's right. And 18 years ago, it ran on 4 gigs of RAM on a fairly 18-year-old machine.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you can't really run Hannah Montana Linux. And, you know, Hannah Montana Linux is so relevant nowadays. I don't know what the guy who wrote it, some guy wrote it,
yeah,
and then just abandoned it, and 18 years later picked it up and fixed it. I think that's the most hysterical thing that I've heard of in a very long time. It just amuses the heck out of me. Hannah Montana Linux. It's out there. There are a lot of niche Linuxes.
I mean, the different version. Well, we've said this before, that you could start right now. This is only July, and go to the end of the year, watching all the different videos on the different flavors of Linux and different things that you can do with each flavor therein. And as far as installing and, you know, undoing stuff and how much it requires, I mean, you could literally take the rest of the year learning about all the different flavors and features and what this version will do for you versus the other version, and totally go blind.
There's a list of distrowatch.com. There's a list of the 100 top Linux distributions, and that's only the top 100.
Yeah. And that's what I mean. Even within those, though, you've got to learn the different features that are in each version and what it'll do for you. All right, say you take Cinnamon. And within Cinnamon, whether you want it to look like a Mac, a PC, or actually a Linux machine.
Right.
And how you would work with those features within it.
Command line only.
There's a version of Linux for that. Yeah. There's several, as a matter of fact. There's also a waiting list of things that they haven't even gotten to yet at distrowatch.com, and Hannah Montana Linux is on that list. So that's good to know. But the beautiful thing about Linux is that it's open source.
Mm-hmm.
The terrible thing about Linux is that it's open source. So pretty much anybody can pick up the base concept of Linux and create their own distribution. That doesn't mean it's a good distribution, but it means it's theirs. So if you're looking to get into Linux, distrowatch.com, where you can look at the various different versions of it and see what's there. Mint is currently number 2. Catchy OS is number 1. That's because it's new hotness, not because it's the best.
Well, one of the things, though, I got to say positive for Linux, though, is there's been so many videos put out, excuse me, that show people, you know, because they sit there and say, well, I only know Windows. I only know Mac. And this is a whole other operating system. Well, they have made it so easy for you to create a boot disk, try it out before installing on that machine. Granted, it won't run super fast because it's got to unpack and pack things, but you can get a flavor for it.
I'm writing this slow because I know you don't read very fast.
Yeah, right. but yeah, so they're, you know, most people go to Linux Mint or Zorin or, you know, Ubuntu, Fedora. If you're going to look at Linux, They say right now, they say the best Linux for Windows users is Mint. It is the closest to Windows. The desktop looks very similar. Like Dave said, you can make it look very different, but it comes up looking very much the same, and that makes it easy for a person who's used to Windows.
And check out some of the videos before you even try this. Right. Look at the videos that people are doing demos on. Oh, well, I tried this out, and here's what I found. Watch what other folks have done. And I think your stress level will come down a little bit, or nervousness, I should say, on, you know, trying it. Because we always tell folks, oh, you got this old computer that's just sitting there now. Turn it into a Linux box. One, it's an old box, so you can't mess it up. And if you watch enough videos, you'll be able to do it, no problem. Get it up and running, and you play with it as a side machine.
Right. Right. And there's a lot of Linuxes and a lot of versions and a lot of languages. If you're one of those people who prefers a non-English language version of Linux, you can get that. Or you can just tell it when you start up. One of the questions it asks you is, what language do you want? And there's like 50 of them. So you ought to find something that you speak somewhere in that list.
We had a customer once accidentally pick Austrian because that was alphabetically first.
Sure.
Took us a while to get it back to English because none of us spoke Austrian.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites right here on the truly great and truly, truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just a couple of minutes.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And 34 minutes after the hour, that's a YouTube strike. We are Soundbites.
Might have gone a little too long there.
Yeah, and you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Or toll free at 800-790-0415. Copying and pasting large amounts of text has always been a bit sluggish in Google Docs. They say it's going to get faster. Big boon for plagiarizers and people who let AI do all their thinking. Speaking of AI, using Apple Intelligence camera features in the home app will require an iCloud Plus plan starting at 2 terabytes, according to Apple. Apple shared the detail in its notes for the third macOS Golden Gate beta that was released on Monday. In iOS 27, iPad OS 27, and macOS 27 Golden Gate, the home app is able to generate written summaries for motion alerts from HomeKit secure video cameras. It's also able to group footage from separate cameras for an overview of activity and pull out noteworthy recordings, plus it supports natural language search. For the home features, users will need the 2 terabyte iCloud Plus plan or better. The 2 terabyte plan includes 2 terabytes of iCloud storage, and it costs $10 a month. Google is rolling out the first update to Android 17 with the July 2026 security patch for the Pixel 6. I'm not going to read them all. It's everything from the Pixel 6 on up. Refreshingly, there are no security issues involved in the Android 17 July patch. Apple now uses Google servers to power some of its new and upcoming AI features, and the company is using a pop-up to notify and request users' permission in both iOS 27 and iOS 26. You'll get the usually allow once, always allow, and cancel choices. With Samsung shutting down Samsung Messages this week, there you go to the people who were talking about Samsung Messages, and a massive new group of users moving over to Google Messages, folks are starting to notice changes as Google works to improve its messaging app in a hurry. Some are cosmetic, some are process-related. These changes are rolling out, so don't get excited if you don't see them. Apple stopped signing a bunch of older OS versions so you couldn't roll back to them. Then they changed their mind and started signing them again. So if you tried to roll back to an earlier OS and couldn't, try again. Following Android's backup policy change this week, Google is rolling out new settings to control whether SMS, MMS, and RCS settings are backed up. Additionally, Android is beginning to introduce local documents backup. When you go to settings, accounts, and backup, Google backup other devices data. On Pixel, there are new on-off toggles from SMS, SMS, MMS, and although don't say it, RCS messages, call history and device settings, and of course, these will take up space in your 15 gigs, so turn off whatever you don't feel you need. But don't turn us off. Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Yeah, Samsung is turning off Samsung messages. Why? Because it's garbage and people aren't using it anymore. And everybody, most everybody who has paid attention has moved over to Google messages.
It always made me wonder why companies bothered to make an app when that app already comes with the phone.
Ads.
Yeah.
If you're going to put ads in your app, you want it to be your app, not theirs.
Yep.
That's pretty much how that works. Google Messages is shut down, so you should probably just start using... Excuse me. Samsung Messages is shutting down, so you should probably start using Google Messages instead. All right. To the phones. Our next caller is Brian from Rochester, New York. What's up, Brian?
Hello, gentlemen. I originally had one question, but you mentioned the... Samsung messages and Google messages, and so that's another question. I have Samsung switched over to Google, but I was looking, and I don't think I've been able to find anything. Or is there a reliable another message app that you can use besides Google Messages? That's question one, and question two. Oh well, I did see WhatsApp, but that had some limitations. And the next question I had. It was related to Linux. So you mentioned a moment ago that you use Linux.
Yeah.
So as a Windows user, all you guys use Linux. As a Windows user, are there limitations to Windows software that I'm used to using, say, productivity, Microsoft, whatever, that I could use on Linux? Are there limitations? Are there some programs that will not work on Linux that I currently use, or that are popular, I should say, that are popular on Windows systems?
You might find a variation thereof.
Right. The reality is that Windows programs do not work on Linux, so you cannot use Microsoft Office. However, there is a program called OpenOffice. It does everything Microsoft Office does. It has all the same features and more. For example, it has a database component, and it's free. And it reads and writes Microsoft formatted documents. So you can read all of your Microsoft documents on it.
Okay.
There are a couple of little things that are different. So, you know, menu choices are a little different in a couple of places. After about a week, we've said this 100,000 times, it's like buying a new car, which two of us just recently did. You still know how to drive, it's just the radio's in a different place.
Right. Is there like a list or a, is there a database or a list or something of programs that does Linux provide that says, okay, well, you used to use this program in Microsoft, now you can use our program or these programs in Linux. Is there something like, does that exist?
Yeah, there's a site called alternative2.net.
And which actually even works for Mac and Windows. If you don't want to pay for Microsoft Office on Windows, you can use one of these other free Office programs on Windows, too.
Right. And so if you go to alternative2.net, and you can type in something like Microsoft Office. Right?
Gotcha.
Or Microsoft 365 Copilot now. God forbid you change it to something else. And
I get an advertisement for Hannah Montana Linux at the top of Alternative 2.
Nice.
It's listening to me. Oh, my gosh.
And you can see what that is, and then there's an alternatives button. And if you click on that, you will see LibreOffice and OnlyOffice and WPS Office and Apache OpenOffice and CryptPad and SoftMaker FreeOffice and Office Suite and Collabora. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There are a lot of alternatives to Microsoft products, and for, you know, people who use light table, there's dark
room.
Room to dark table.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of alternatives to Windows programs. Most of them work almost identically. Like I said, there will be small differences. If you've been using a program for 20 years, your muscle memory is going to be a little wrong for a couple of the commands. But generally speaking, you know, within a week, you won't even remember there was a difference.
Okay, great. Thank you. Is that alternative the number two or alternative TO?
TO. And as far as an alternative messaging app, the gold standard is still Google Messages.
Well, one of the problems is what kind of messages you're talking about. There are text messages and internet messages. And you had mentioned WhatsApp. That's internet only and only works to other people that have WhatsApp.
Same with Signal.
Same with Signal and Telegram and some of the dedicated messaging apps. So looking for an app that does cellular text messaging is different than a internet messaging app.
But the one most people are using for texting, RCS messaging, all of that stuff, is Google Messages.
Yeah, thank you. I looked that up, and that was pretty much the same conclusion I came to. I just thought maybe I missed something.
No, that's it.
And that the limitations, and so, because the other person that you're sending the message to also has to be using WhatsApp, Signal, So
you might also find that, you know, within Linux, some programs run on... like, I use Money Dance for my finances. Well, Money Dance runs on all three platforms, Mac, PC, and Linux. So you might find some programs that will run on multiple platforms.
Great. Okay, because that's something I've heard you guys mention before, and I've done a couple of tutorials on learning how to use that. So that's great to know. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks.
Have a great day.
You too, Brian. Bye-bye. Yeah, the moving to Linux sounds
intimidating.
Scary.
Yeah,
And I guess it can be. I didn't find it so. I don't think you would find it so. The reality is that looking at it as I have to move everything is frightening. But if you think I'm going to start by learning, take Nibble. How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time?
Yep.
So, you know, start by learning a little bit about the operating system. Like Dave has said many times, get an old machine, put it on that. Now you don't give up your new machine, your Windows machine, while you're learning stuff on the Linux machine.
Yep.
And eventually you will find frankly, that's how I did it.
And don't keep putting yourself down by saying you're not a techie.
Right. No.
You don't need to be a techie.
Right.
There are so much, like I keep stressing, there are so many videos out there that can enlighten you and do away with that intimidation that, it's a scary app. I don't want to do this. I might mess things up. It's common people that are doing these demos just to prove that, you know, yeah, you too can do this.
Right. I've said this before, but I'll say it again. The reason I started playing with Linux is I was the systems administrator of the Saunders College, and people kept sending me emails with attachments. Is this a virus? Don't send it to me! So I set up a Linux machine with mail on it so that I could test that. I could look at those things.
And that's a college, folks.
That's a college, folks.
Surely got a...
And eventually, I started realizing that I was spending most of my day on the Linux side. Things happened much faster, much cleaner, much less SURUS.
Safer,
easier, faster. Why would I go back? So eventually, I put Linux on the new machine and Windows on the old machine and never looked at the old machine.
Shirley got a file the other day from someone in ODT format.
Yeah.
And so she couldn't open it on her phone.
Right, of course.
No native ODT viewer. And so I had to install LibreOffice and converted it to a PDF for her. And then she said that she wanted two printouts. Oh, they're 40 pages long, darn it.
Yeah.
And my printer doesn't have an automatic duplexer, so I had to do manual duplexing.
I hate that.
And it misfed one page. So
of course it did.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Of course it did. When people started telling me, how do I convert my Word documents? Okay, now I can do it. How do I convert my Word documents to PDF? I got confused because LibreOffice has always been able
to
do that.
Yeah, it's always an option there.
Save as PDF. Now, yeah. Of course, Word does it as well.
Well, because, you used to have to buy the Adobe Acrobat Suite to save a PDF.
Right. You used to have to buy it, not me.
Yeah. Well, the Apple has it built in, too, print. But it's print to PDF, not save to PDF.
Right.
Because PDF is almost PostScript, which is the printing language.
Mm-hmm.
Right. PostScript is fourth.
Yeah.
We used to write code in fourth to print stuff. In PostScript. To print stuff. That used
back
to be
in
fun.
The day.
Yeah, that used to be fun. The world was very different back then. We spent more time programming and less time watching memes.
And now we're running into... Well, we're going to run into issues with AI has replaced all the low-tier programmers, so there's no one learning anything to become the mid-tier and high-tier programmers we need to control the AI.
Well,
somebody had said once, I can't believe you can't write a 10-page paper without having AI. And the rebuttal is, I wrote a 10-page paper by reading the synopsis on the back of the book, not even the whole book.
I wrote an exam question. This was when I was in the seminary. Yes, I did spent time in the seminary. I once wrote a question, an answer, by rephrasing the question for a page and a half. That's all I did, and I got an A on it.
Nice.
You
probably saw a page and a half, and that looks like an A.
Yes, probably.
Is that what Rodney Dangerfield movie where he's holding it upside? Oh, that feels like a B. Gives it to a NASA scientist. Make that an A. And then Kurt Vonnegut shows up to teach him English about Kurt Vonnegut.
No, I just heard an ad though. Microsoft is looking to hire tech people and programmers.
Well, they're finding that AI is not doing the job for them.
Yeah, and they let go so many. And now all of a sudden, now they're scrambling to get competent people back in to straighten out the mess that AI is doing.
Yep.
And they're in a panic right now, trying to find people because a lot of them are saying, no.
Right. So if you're a Mac or a Windows user, you can use the DuckDuckGo browser. It is unfortunately not available for Linux. But they have announced, DuckDuckGo has announced, that its browser can now block most video ads on YouTube.
Ooh.
Including those shown before the video starts playing and during playback, interstitials. The feature is enabled by default in the latest version of DuckDuckGo for iOS, Mac, and Windows. iOS, Mac, and Windows, isn't that the same? Oh, because iOS is the...
Yeah.
Okay. While Android users can enable it manually by going to the settings, ad blocking. YouTube is the world's largest video platform, serving billions of users worldwide. We're on it.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from
22 people currently watching on YouTube.
Apart from YouTube premium subscribers, free users are shown ads that help fund operational costs and creator payouts. However, in recent years, these ads have become more frequent, longer, and in some cases, unskippable. DuckDuckGo's new ad-blocking mechanism is separate from the Duck Player, which is an embedded YouTube player in the browser that uses YouTube's strictest privacy settings to prevent tracking cookies and personalized ads. Instead, the new ad blocking system relies on community-maintained filter lists from uBlock Origin to detect and block YouTube ads. So if it's a super new video, you probably will see ads. But
the first person to watch the video gets the lucky thing of showing the ads.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It is supplemented by its own compatibility rules to further strengthen its effectiveness. The Federal Communications Commission, God bless them, will vote to eliminate a rule that requires internet service providers to list all of their so-called pass-through fees on an easily accessible broadband price label. The FCC vote could also make the price labels themselves a bit harder for consumers to find. The Biden-era FCC rules require that ISPs itemize on the label all discretionary monthly fees that the provider passes through to the consumer. The change drew protests from Comcast and other ISPs that complained bitterly about the complexity of listing all the hidden fees they had chosen to charge. Poor babies. A Linux kernel vulnerability dubbed JanEscape allows attackers to escape a virtual machine and execute arbitrary code on the host. It's the first guest-to-host exploit that can be triggered on both Intel and AMD processor architectures rather than being limited to a single platform, and noted that it poses a distinct risk to multi-tenant public cloud environments such as those offered by Google Cloud and Amazon Web Services. Updates are rolling out, so keep an eye out for those of you who use those services. Anthropic quickly removed a tracker secretly monitoring Claude code users after a security researcher exposed the hidden code and condemned the spyware-like tracking as a serious breach of user trust. Anthropic engineer Tariq Shishipar, confirmed that the tracker was added to Claude code as an experiment in March. And the experiment was, are they going to notice? This particularly shocked users after Anthropic stated an anti-surveillance stance, which clearly was a lie. At last, I read that one all over. That's the Hannah Montana Linux. It's still that pink theme, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You can't get away from that pink theme. Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 800-790-0415. It amazes me the number of trackers that people are using out there. I guess it shouldn't surprise me. That's the whole point of most of this stuff.
Yeah.
The only way anybody has found to make money on the internet is selling ads. The only way you know how to target those ads is by knowing who your customers are.
Tracking.
The only way you know how your customers are is by tracking them. So now, here's the conspiracy theory. We were talking about Hannah Montana Linux,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly Steve gets an ad for Hannah Montana
yep.
Linux. What just happened there?
Well, it could be listening to our podcast,
that's
maybe.
That's the point. That's,
yeah.
Yes.
And,
I had Googled Hannah Montana Linux when you were talking about it, and then an ad shows up because Google sells most of the ads on the internet.
That's exactly right. So he Googled it.
Mm-hmm.
Google said, oh, here's a 15-year-old girl. Let's show her a Hannah Montana ad.
That's why if I'm going to do any searching for any kind of product, I automatically open up DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo is a privacy thing.
I mean,
that doesn't we don't think.
We know
they don't share your stuff, and we believe them so far. So because people have done a lot of testing.
But the minute you say do that in Chrome, do a search, you are inundated. And what ticks me off even more is after I buy the product, it's still suggesting that I buy it again.
Especially when it goes on sale and it's less than you
yeah.
buy it for. But it's a real shame. Google was working on a much more privacy-focused advertising system. And in the EU, the advertising lobby sued them. And the court sided with the advertisers, and Google cannot produce a privacy-forward advertising system.
Right.
Because the advertisers would lose too much money.
Right.
Which was very shocking in the EU, because they're usually more...
Customer-focused.
Consumer-focused. Consumer-focused, not business-focused.
Right. I don't get it, but fine. Whatever. I don't know what to say about that.
Probably because Google is an American company, and a lot of the EU courts are pushing back against American companies because so many American companies are having trouble in the EU.
But given that Microsoft is using the GDID, the Global Device Identifier,
mm-hmm.
I keep wanting GD to mean something else, the GDID, and how all of those things track you using Linux with DuckDuckGo as your browser, as your search engine, and something like Brave as your browser, makes a whole lot more sense to me than using. And I've discovered recently that Brave does the same thing that Google does in that you can sign up with Brave, and it will remember all of your bookmarks and stuff across platforms. So from my desktop to my laptop to my phone or whatever, I have all the same bookmarks and setups and folders and all that other stuff. All right, that music tells us we are done for another week. A lot of calls this week, a lot of good calls this week. So thanks to everybody who called in. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray. Because if I don't, he hurts me. I'm Nick Francesco. Again, I want to thank each and every one of you who called in. I really want to thank each and every one of you who worked so hard to try to get us toward our goal this year for our fun drive. We're still here. We appreciate that. And we will see you next week on a whole new edition of the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's Sound Bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?